Thanks for being with us for Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Here we are, midweek already. How did that happen, Greg?
I love it. I just got back from vacation yesterday.
Yeah, Greg Bluestein. And by the way, of course, that is Greg Bluestein, who is a political reporter, and I always say the lead political reporter for the AJC. He doesn't like to hear that, but he has more bylines than any other reporter in the paper, so it seems to work for me. And Greg Bluestein, if you don't mind, we should say you had a birthday over the weekend. Happy birthday, Greg.
Thank you. We were in Hilton Head with the family to celebrate.
Wow, Greg's finally 30 years old.
Wow.
Thank goodness.
A couple years older than that.
All right. Thank you for being here. If you're watching us on Facebook Live, right across from him is Eric Tannenblatt. He is a well-known Republican in Georgia. He has worked with everybody from Mitt Romney, both of the Bushes, when they ran their presidential campaigns, to Senator Paul Coverdale, and continues to be one of the most significant fundraisers in the Southeast as well. How are you, Eric?
I am doing well. Glad to be back.
I should also point out the head of global government affairs for Dentons, the world's largest law firm.
That's right.
All right. Thank you. Cody Hall is with us. He is press secretary to Governor Brian Kemp. Cody, how's it going over there in the governor's office? You've now been there for, it's been, what, 5 months now?
It feels like a lot longer than that. but we had a restful weekend, so we're ready to hit the ground running this week.
Good, good. And we're so happy to have Stacey Evans back with us. You all know that Stacey ran for governor in the Democratic primaries in 2018. She served in the state legislature. And now we can say definitively, we can lay to rest rumors that she was going to run for chair of the Cobb County Commission because she is no longer living in Cobb County.
Hi, Stacey. Hi, good to be here. Yes, we closed on a house this morning, so we are officially Fulton County residents.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
All right, I want to make a couple of announcements, and then we'll plunge into the news. First of all, remember, we're going to be in Cartersville on Monday night, this coming Monday night, June 3rd. We're going to do the show in front of a live audience at the historic Grand Theater. Tom Faust was up there doing a site survey, and he came back and said, wow, that's a beautiful theater. And it is. And we're excited that the Grand is going to host us up there. We've also got a number of legislators from up in the Cartersville and Rome area coming to be part of the show. Senator Bruce Thompson is going to be with us. Katie Dempsey from Rome is coming down to be part of the show. Matthew Gamble is going to be there. So they're all going to be there. And although they're not on the panel, we're going to turn this into a town meeting, and everybody's going to get a chance to talk about the issues that matter to them. So we still have seats. It's a big venue. Join us if you can. Just go to politicalrewind.org. Click on the link that takes you to the page where you can get free tickets. And we would love to have you there on a Monday night as we record the show for air next Tuesday. So that's the one big announcement I wanted to make. But I also, before we get into today's topics, I want to do a quick fact check. If you were listening to Rewind yesterday, you may have noticed it got to be a somewhat raucous show at times. And because we talked about abortion, of course, there was some heated conversation. At one point, one of our panelists made the statement that younger voters are increasingly becoming pro-life. We didn't know where that came from. We didn't know the source of the panelists' information. And it turned out, in fact, it was based on something that he'd read in a number of newspapers or whatever. So I went in and I did a quick check. I looked at two of the most reputable pollsters in the United States. And I want you to know that the Pew Research Center shows that young people 18 to 29, in fact, believe that abortion should be legal in all or most cases by a good 25%, and only a handful say it should be illegal. And then I went to Pew Research, to Gallup, and Gallup did a poll on this. They say that right now, let me see if I've got it right in front of me, 55% of voters between 18 and 29 identify themselves as pro-choice, 38% as pro-life. So I just wanted to point that out because when we have an opportunity to fact check something that's been said on the show, we want to do that.
Can I ask a question
sure,
about that? Is that
of course.
Are those national numbers?
Those are national numbers, okay. And the latest numbers, I'm sorry, thank you.
Okay.
2018 is the most recent polling on that. And in fact, they track that over a period of years, and the numbers do go up and down. But the trend has been toward younger voters being pro-choice, which, Greg, I don't think it's terribly surprising. Younger voters seem to be a bit more progressive than their parents.
Yeah, particularly with social issues, and the AJC's polling of Georgia voters reflects the same sort of trend.
Okay.
Even though it's a much smaller subset.
All right. Let's talk for a couple minutes about the big national story today, of course. That's Robert Mueller gave a statement today. For the first time, he appeared in public since he began the special investigation more than 2 years ago. He said, this is it. He appeared at a podium in the Justice Department, which I thought in and of itself, Eric, was interesting. Given that he was going to be resting in the breast of the Justice Department, he wasn't about to go off wildly critical of what was happening, what Barr had done, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and I think that his press conference today sort of brought him back to who Robert Mueller is. I mean, he's someone with a distinguished career in public service, distinguished career in law enforcement. He did what he was asked to do, and he's been criticized by some, praised by others, and I think he just wanted to, you know, let, you know, have an opportunity to speak for himself and, you know, just say that's it.
Stacey, he did say that he hopes this will be his only public statement on the report, that he did not want to testify. He felt that the report itself was his testimony. But let's read the money quote from his entire statement. He said, if we had confidence the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so. Now, we've basically heard that in reading the report itself, or even the summary of the report that William Barr put out. But to hear it come out of his mouth was a different matter.
Yeah, I mean, it's not something that should give Republicans any comfort at all. That's not a happy statement to hear about the president. I do hope, personally, that this is the end of the efforts to try to get Mueller in front of a camera, though. I've always thought if he went before Congress, he would simply say, the document speaks for itself, sort of like in a deposition when somebody asked, what does the document say? Well, the document speaks for itself. I don't need to read it to you. And I think that's how he would refer to his report. And he said what he said, and he doesn't have anything else to say.
Cody, we have statements. We asked for statements from members of Georgia's congressional delegation in the immediate aftermath, and we got a couple. David Perdue said, quote, I've been calling for the Mueller report to be made public. I'm glad it's finally out so the American people can see the facts. We know the report concluded there was no collusion, and the attorney general concluded there was no obstruction. It's time to move on. Let's start legislating and stop investigating. That's David Perdue. And then we got this from Doug Collins. And of course, Cody, we know Doug Collins has become the first line of defense for President Trump, given his role as the Republican leader on the Judiciary Committee, the ranking member on Judiciary. Here's what he said. Doug Collins, for the past 2 years, Robert Mueller has done something no one thought was possible in Washington, stay out of the spotlight and diligently conduct his work. Well, I had hoped he would come before the committee and answer questions from lawmakers. Robert Mueller has led an extraordinary life of public service. He's entitled to his life as a private citizen once again. And then he goes on and says, Special Counsel Mueller confirmed today what we knew months ago when this report was released. There was no collusion and no obstruction. And he goes on from there. So, Cody, we have from both Perdue and Collins this statement, no obstruction, no collusion. That isn't quite what Robert Mueller said today.
You know, I think it was about an hour and a half before he spoke that they sent out a media advisor that he was going to speak. And I always say a silent prayer for all the comms folks up in D.C. that their entire day of what they had planned out is now thrown in the wastebasket. Yeah. I think both Perdue and Collins had it right. I mean, and Doug Collins is my congressman. And I hope that we can use this. In my opinion, I listened to what the special counsel had to say. I think you could sum it up in terms of what he had to say to read the report. And I think now that we've kind of reached the end of this, he's essentially said he's not going to give any further testimony. Hopefully, I'm going to be optimistic here, that the country can kind of use this as a pivot point, that Congress can get to work on things like maybe not taking 7 months to pass the next relief bill for folks that are impacted by storms, maybe try to work on infrastructure, maybe, hopefully, we can use this point to start getting some stuff done before we kick into the election cycle next year.
Greg?
It's the end of this phase, but I don't think it's the end of this at all. I mean, he formally closed his investigation. He declined to clear President Trump of obstruction of justice. He said that Justice Department policy prohibits charging a sitting president with a crime, but he noted that the Constitution provides for another avenue. He didn't say impeachment, but he certainly alluded to that avenue. Kind of kicked the ball to Congress. It's like, Congress, your move is next.
Yeah, I think it'd be wishful thinking if we think this is going to be over. I mean, I think it's going to be the topic of all the talk shows, cable talk shows tonight. And, you know, the Democrats are going to continue to pound the table and want to keep this going. So, unfortunately, I don't think we're going to be able to turn the page.
And, of course, the White House is echoing this notion that no obstruction, no collusion was the outcome of this. Stacey Evans, this is going to linger all the way through the 2020 election cycle.
Sure. But talk about fact-checking.
Yeah.
We've had to fact-check just three statements already just sitting here about the report. Sounds like there's a couple of folks in Congress and in the White House that haven't read the report.
All right. Well, we're going to watch how this unfolds. If we get any more statements from our delegation during the show, we'll report them back to you. But I mean, this is going to continue on and be an issue that I think we'll be talking about for a long time.
And as you mentioned, 2020, you already seen a presidential candidate, Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey, come out and with his most strident comments supporting the path towards impeachment. And you might hear some other presidential candidates do the same now that we have this latest Mueller statement.
Okay. Greg Bluestein, let's talk about a story that you filed yesterday, you and your colleague James Salzer, who works down at the Capitol, an exclusive story about getting more depth, looking at something that you'd reported previously, but you had a lot more detail now, about the state ethics chief, David Imadi, and the first investigation he is taking on now that he's in that job.
Yeah, David Imadi had made the unusual statement once he took the job that one of his first acts would be to pursue more documents, more details, an investigation into Stacey Abrams' campaign finances, as well as some unnamed Atlanta mayoral candidates. He followed through on that April 26th. He filed a subpoena seeking documents from Abrams and eight groups affiliated with her in some form or fashion, mostly left-leaning groups that either one of them was Fair Fight Action, the group that she helped start fighting for voting rights. One of them is New Georgia Project, another group she helped start to expand voter registration. And then several groups that either sprung up to support her or were already existing but put money, put heft behind her campaign in some form or fashion. What Imadi is seeking is all correspondence, documents involving any sort of support they gave to her, any financial records, bank records, financial statements, a whole ledger of different things that he's seeking. And what he said in one of the correspondence back and forth between him and Stacey Abrams' attorney is that he's looking at four groups in particular. One of them was co-founded by Senator Nikema Williams, who's now the chairwoman of the Georgia Democratic Party, to see if they had surpassed their financial limits, if they have violated state campaign finance law by giving too much money or giving too much support to Stacey Abrams' campaign. And of course, those groups all vigorously deny this. And Stacey Abrams' attorney says she questions whether there's a coincidence that they are seeking groups led largely by Latino or African-American leaders who supported Stacey Abrams.
So let's be clear about something. Mm-hmm. This is the first major investigation launched since he became head of the commission. He is a Republican, Eric. He's also a prosecutor from, I think, Douglas County. And so the question becomes, we know, Eric, that in the past there have been questions raised about some of the finances surrounding Stacey Abrams' organizations. We know there were some questions raised about her voter registration campaign, just in terms of sheer numbers of people who she registered, although that's not really a part of this. I think this has more to do with finances. So so maybe there's something here that he wants to look at that matters, but how does this look that he takes on what appears to be a partisan investigation as his first act in this job?
Well, I have to believe he thought about that before he did it, that people would accuse him of being political and partisan. So my guess is there's probably some there, and I guess the facts will bear out through this process.
Stacey?
Well, I hope that Mr. Amati is not playing politics here. I don't know him personally. I know of his professional reputation, and seems to be a good one. We'll find out. I think he probably would have been smart to launch investigations of someone on the Republican side, too, at the same time. It's hard for me to believe there's not any suspicious activity that occurred in one of those gubernatorial campaigns as well. But obviously, I don't know that. But I wonder, with all due respect to my friend Greg Bluestein, whether it is as big of a deal as it seems to be made out to be in the media. I talked to some folks that were at the first press conference that Mr. Amati gave, and his statements about issuing subpoenas related to Stacey Abrams' campaign was in response to a question. It wasn't something that he led with. This is what I'm coming out here to talk about. He was responding to a question, and that ended up being the headline. And then now there have been these subpoenas, but we don't know what other subpoenas may or may not be out there.
Yeah, no, good point. You usually, when you have these state ethics officials, they keep things close to the vest. So the very fact that he was talking openly about pursuing an investigation of Stacey Abrams the day that he was being introduced publicly to the media was news. My colleague James Salzer covered that one. And we know that these subpoenas seem to be the only ones, as far as we can tell, that have been issued involving gubernatorial candidates. Maybe you can illuminate if you've gotten one or if any of your campaign anyone from your campaign has gotten one. But he says he's auditing all the gubernatorial campaigns, and he said that on the record. But what we know for sure now is that Stacey Abrams and eight other affiliated groups have gotten these subpoenas.
Well, Cody, you're here. Are you aware of any audit that's going on with your campaign finances that Amati's taken up?
Right, so I want to be clear that I'm here for the office of the governor, not necessarily the campaign side.
Right.
I'm not aware of any, but that wouldn't be outside the realm of possibility that I wouldn't know. I think there are a couple things to keep in mind here. That there's a reason why we have a new director of the Ethics Commission. The last one had several complaints that were put into the commission that he didn't act on. The board felt that that was a problem. He was also using state government time for extracurricular activities that shouldn't have been going on. The other point I will make is that the governor doesn't appoint this individual. It's made by the board. The board's five folks. It's a bipartisan board, and the governor's only had one appointment on that board since his time as governor. So, and I'll also add that being a Republican, and Eric and I are glad to know this, is not a crime. So someone can have served in a position as a Republican or voted Republican and still go on to do a very good job in public service. So I'll say that, you know.
Give it time.
Right. Right. I'll say that I think everyone expects a state institution like the Ethics Commission to be above board, nonpartisan, and that's the expectation that myself as a Georgian would have of this guy.
So Greg, Cody did make an important point there. We do know, that Amati's predecessor was slow walking a number of complaints that had come in. What do we know about any partisanship behind what he was doing?
Yeah, there were internal complaints, even from his own staffers, that Stefan Ritter was ignoring valid investigations out there. He ended up getting ousted for that and other reasons. But we have not seen any accusations. There was partisanship behind it. More of there were people that, I guess, laziness was one of the concerns.
Right.
And he got too comfortable or cozy in the job. He, of course, denies all that. But there are any number of campaign violations that even us as reporters have exposed and written about, and there's countless ethics complaints. So there's a lot of fodder for whoever's in the ethics office to investigate, and there just wasn't a lot of that investigation going on before.
Cody?
I think the other thing I was going to add that actually I heard Brian Robinson talk about yesterday is that once upon a time, back in far, far history, there was a Republican governor who was investigated by this very ethics commission. It wasn't the same staff as it is now, but this group has went after Republicans before. And I do think that that's interesting that there are Democrats that are trying to cast this individual and this board in a negative light. Well, I would maybe say that they should hold their horses and wait until maybe they look into a Republican at some point, and then they have to walk back all of their accusations.
I think that makes a certain amount of sense. You're a pretty shrewd communications guy, Cody. You proved that during the campaign, and you're proving it in the governor's office. Do you think possibly because of your understanding of how people perceive news that comes out, that it might have been a good idea if Amati could have found some kind of Republican activity to investigate and announce them simultaneously?
I'm always very glad to know that there are people who don't think like me. And I think that Mr. Amati, he's focused on doing the right thing, maybe not what the folks in the media or I may think is optically great, but I trust that he's doing the right thing. And until there's evidence to prove otherwise, we should trust the process.
But, you know, Stacey, let's put a period on this because I want to get to a break in a minute. But so the Abrams people, of course, are crying foul on this. They really think that this is totally partisan, that it's an attempt to undermine Stacey Abrams. I suppose one of the proofs is going to be what happens when this investigation is complete. If in fact there's nothing substantive there, then it's going to end up being a wash for Abrams. Nothing to worry about in the long run, I guess.
Certainly, if she thinks it's pure politics, if that's the case, then she should cooperate, provide the proof, and it'll be over. And then she'll have the last laugh.
Any last words? Because Eric, you want to get a last word on this?
Well, I think that she will, like she's done everything, will turn this into a political opportunity. And I'm sure we'll see her on national cable news programs talking about how she's a victim.
What a shock.
Yeah.
A Democrat, or for that matter, a Republican, turning news into a political opportunity, Bluestein.
Yeah. And look, they have, and yesterday you kind of saw that her Fair Fight Action was had a GIF out there saying, or GIF, about a fishing expedition. That was one of the quotes in the documents. But look, they also have said, hey, there, we could have technical issues. They raised $30 million, so not all the data points might be completely correct, and they're looking to fix them. So it'll be interesting to see how many of these errors there are, and if there's anything really big substantive errors that really violated, you know, that were flagrant violations of campaign finance.
All right. Well, so what's interesting as we go to break is that Amati has certainly put himself a new position where people are going to be watching his office's actions in the months to come very, very closely. Let's do this. Let's get our first break of the show out of the way. And when we come back, we got a lot more to talk about on today's Political Rewind.
Hey, this is David Green, host of Morning Edition. I'm here to talk with you about that poking feeling, the one that keeps reminding you to support public radio. You can support the programs you love by donating your used vehicle. That old car or truck could be worth hundreds of dollars to this station. All you have to do is call, and you might even receive a tax deduction.
Go to gpb.org/cars or call 877-GPB-1-CAR and thanks.
In the 1980s and 90s, activists fought to fast-track AIDS medicines by confronting the government. Now they're back at it. The new target? Cheaper access to an HIV prevention pill. I'm Ari Shapiro, taking on the high price of HIV medication this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
4 till 7 today on GPB and gpbnews.org.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I do have a public service announcement to start this segment, which is this. No, I don't want to relitigate HB 481, the abortion bill, over and over and over again on every edition of Political Rewind. And as we talk about it a little bit today, I'm asking the panel to follow along. Let's not relitigate the entire thing. But Cody Hall.
I was going to ask which bill you were referring to.
I think you know pretty well. Cody, I do want to ask you a question about this and then bring the whole panel in. We now know that Netflix has become the first production company that's spoken out in opposition to the abortion law in Georgia. I suppose the good news, if you're in your office, is they're not pulling out of Georgia. They're saying, we'll stay here, but we're now going to contribute to the effort by ACLU and whatever other organizations eventually file suit to stop the law before it's supposed to go into effect on January 1st. But here's what I want to ask you about that. Your boss, the governor, we've already discussed on this show a couple of times the red meat that he threw out about this at the state convention. Greg Bluestein reported on it then. We've talked about it on the show. We're not going to let a bunch of Hollywood liberals essentially tell us about what our moral values ought to be. But here's what I'm curious to know. I get that you do that for the base. But at the same time, your office has got to figure out a way to communicate positively with the Los Angeles production companies. How are you starting to formulate how you're doing that?
I think it starts off, so 2 years ago, actually April 1st, of 2019 was 2 years ago since the governor launched his campaign, and I think every time since, he's not only re-emphasized his support of the tax credit program that we have here, but also the workforce development things that we have going on that make Georgia a great place, one of the top in the nation to produce films here. And he's reiterated his support of that program and of the industry throughout this whole kind of episode we've had. I think, and he actually, we traveled down to Pinewood Studios. Mm. I think it was last week. All my weeks are blending together. But in the not-too-distant past, to talk to folks that are in the industry here, make sure that they knew how the governor felt. And it was a good time. It was a good tour.
But what's he saying to them?
I think he's saying what he has said publicly. That's everyone will soon, if folks didn't pay attention on the campaign, they will soon find out that Brian Kemp is a guy that once he says something, he's going to keep his word. And during the campaign, he believed in this issue. He campaigned very clearly about how he felt. The other side made sure everyone knew how he felt about the issue. I think Jim Galloway had a few columns about how the other side was using the governor's stance on life throughout the campaign. And, you know, up until now, and I think going forward, the state and the film industry have had a great relationship in business. And I think Netflix and any other corporation or individual is fully within their constitutional rights to say that we're going to donate to Group A or Group B in order to fight the law. They can do that. But whenever you do take a position on a political issue, you have to get ready for the political dialogue that goes back and forth. And the governor's been very clear about how he feels on this issue, and he's going to continue to be in the future.
So thank you for that. I do think it's worth pointing out, Greg, that we're not talking about what we've heard so far is not what you call genuine dialogue. What we heard was Cody's boss call the opponents C-list celebrities. It was insulting. And that's why I was asking Cody, there's got to be another side to that. You don't want to continue to insult the very people who are bringing millions and millions of dollars in jobs into the state.
What the governor said at the convention was a departure from what he's been saying before. He's always kind of said, I fight for Georgia values and Hollywood values. That's been his stock answer. At the convention, he went a step further and he mocked the C-list celebrities. He said, go ahead and boycott if you want. And that's now what you have had to defend.
I think there's a point to be made here that there are folks on both sides of this issue that have passionate opinions, and all you have to do is go to Alyssa Milano's press conference when she was at the state capitol, go to and listen to what some of the Democratic state legislators are saying about the governor and folks who supported this legislation to know that the insulting language is not from one side. I don't perceive the governor's language to be insulting. I will say that it's insulting to me for a Democratic state legislator who's elected by folks to say that people that were in favor of this legislation have blood on their hands. That's just not constructive. And I think, again, when issues like this come into the political sphere, you're going to have a dialogue back and forth. And the governor's going to make his position clear and continue to stand up for that.
Eric, I'd say a good amount of the a good amount of the work you do at Denton's has to do with how you find middle, you know, common ground between people who are dealing with problems that they would like to resolve. What do you say about this? How do you get past the insults and reach out in a productive way to the Hollywood community?
Well, first of all, just to reiterate something Cody alluded to, you know, one thing about Brian Kemp is, and I've been around a lot of politicians, and he's someone that what he says in private is the same as what he says in public. So none of his actions and support for specific pieces of legislation should surprise anyone. I mean, he was very clear with where he stood on the life issue, and very clear of where he stood, as Cody pointed out, on the film industry. And we shouldn't just look at the film industry as Hollywood and Los Angeles. I mean, we've got an industry here, yeah. And we've got production facilities here that are tied to, you know, production outfits in the UK. And so it's not just California. And we have a lot of business leaders in this state that have invested a lot in the Georgia film industry. And a lot of those people are supporters of the Kemp administration and the governor. Now, with regards to Netflix, they have every right to make whatever decisions they want to make. I will point out that, as you said, they have not pulled out. They're still filming here. And, you know, we'll see what happens in the future. They could put, you know, resources to help, you know, oppose the law. But, you know, the film industry is healthy here in Georgia, and I think it's going to continue to grow and prosper. And I think, unfortunately, this is becoming more political by political officials making it more political. And I think it's going to hurt the workers and the people that are involved in the industry.
Some 92,000 Georgians, I think, is the last mm-hmm. number that I
mean, even,
I read.
Even people, you know, like Stacey Abrams, who I, you know, made some, you know, snarky comment about a little while ago. I mean, she even has said to the industry, don't take it out on those workers.
Stacey, you want to jump in?
A $9 billion economic impact. It's a big deal. And I think, to the comment about the C-list celebrities, I think that sort of illustrates the problem with the collision between governing and campaigning. And Governor Kemp should be in governing mode, but you had this convention, he had to go, he had to speak, and he was caught up in the heat of the moment, and he threw some red meat to the crowd, what they wanted to hear. But it was terrible from a governing standpoint, because why would you insult the group that is making this $9 billion impact, that's employing all these people? But I applaud Netflix. I think their response was exactly the right one. They're saying, we're going to stand up for what we think is right. We're going to stay and help. We're not just going to grandstand and talk about how bad this is. And some of the folks that were calling for a boycott have been here, but so many that were calling for the boycott are not even here.
Yeah.
And that frustrates me as a Georgian. I care about the people of this state. I care that we have economic opportunities and job opportunities. So your talk is cheap. And so that's why I applaud Netflix for saying, I'm going to stand with you and fight for you, because we do like the climate in Georgia and we want to be able to stay here. So we're going to try to make this an environment that we're all comfortable with. And to anybody that's further considering a boycott, I would say this. As a lawyer, I don't see how in the world this law is not enjoined. Yes, it will. Some law similar to this one or this one will make it up to the Supreme Court, but that's not the law right here now. There's no reason to leave. Stay here and make sure it doesn't ever become the law.
Greg?
Georgia film executives are heaving a sigh of relief after that Netflix, because they showed a path forward that other studios can follow, saying, you know, we object to the law, we'll help fight the law, but we'll still stay in Georgia. And as Stacey pointed out, a lot of those people who were threatening boycotts had nothing to do with Georgia. And some of the people who have vowed to boycott the state are actually filming productions in Georgia as we speak.
You know what I wonder? We know that since the law doesn't go into effect until January 1st, ACLU of Georgia is taking its time preparing its brief. But Greg, we are also told that that some of the clinics here are already hearing from women who think the law is in effect, and so they're not sure whether they can actually have the procedure or not. I wonder at a certain point whether ACLU, just as a symbolic action, has to start I mean, when are they planning to file their lawsuit? Can they wait until October? Doesn't that just keep this whole thing hanging in the air in a way that's uncomfortable for everyone?
And they let it be known it will be later this summer.
Okay.
But we've been, and actually that's where the responsibility is on the media a lot, is writing that there's a certain legal challenge and that the law won't take effect till January, but will almost definitively be blocked before then, just to let it be known. Because I've had friends wondering, asking all sorts of questions about this, who do read and who do keep up with the media. So imagine the people who just kind of hear it here and there. And we've sent reporters to clinics who have heard from, you know, medical abortion providers who have heard all sorts of stories about people freaking out and worrying that this has already taken effect.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on. There's been some really kind of crazy language around this, and I'll just mention it briefly. I mean, we now have the acting district attorney in Cobb County, John Melvin, mm-hmm. Comparing prosecutors who say they wouldn't prosecute women or doctors based on what he reads this law is allowing to the Nazis. Greg, if we're not careful, this thing is going to spiral out of control in a way that's just, and we hear it sometimes on this show.
How often do we see district attorneys have such an open rift about whether or not they even force the law and what the law would mean if it does take effect? Some, at least one of them says that it could theoretically be used to prosecute women who are seeking abortions. Many of them say that it could definitely be used to prosecute abortion providers. And several Democratic district attorneys say that they wouldn't use it at all to prosecute anyone.
All right. So just to close this out, what's it like to be in the middle of this storm right now, Cody?
I'm a blessed guy.
Good answer.
Right. Job security.
All right. We got a lot more to talk about. Let's get to a break and we'll come back with more.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with children's book author and illustrator Myra Kalman and her son, designer Alex Kalman, about their new book and museum exhibit, Sarah Berman's Closet, the story of her mother, his grandmother, who went from a shtetl to Tel Aviv to New York, and at age 60, left her husband, started a new life, and wore only white. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB and GPBnews.org.
I'm Sarah Ahman. I own Out of the Blue in Blue Ridge, Georgia. We specialize in wines from around the world and high-end cheeses. And we also have craft beer. I think a lot of people that listen to GPB, it's just part of their day-to-day routine. I have people coming up from Atlanta just to see what Out of the Blue is all about because they hear our ads all the time and they say so.
To find out more about becoming a corporate sponsor, email sponsorship@gpb.org.
Great panel today. Stacey Evans is with us. So is Eric Tannenblatt, Cody Hall, the governor's press secretary, and Greg Bluestein, of course. It's Wednesday. We always look forward to having you on our Wednesday show, Greg. Real quick, a little news story. Michael Williams, one of Cody Hall's favorite people, ran for governor, of course, for a while. Finally, they've found that there's an end to his case in which he was accused of making a false report about having campaign computers stolen. And what was the outcome?
Yeah, he pleaded guilty to those charges about lying to a GBI investigator and basically fraud for falsely reporting that computer servers from his campaign office were stolen. It was a very bizarre report. Remember, it raised up a bright red flag to me when I saw it on a local CBS affiliate right before the election, where his campaign manager was saying it was political shenanigans. And this was, even then, this was a candidate that was barely getting any traction. He was in fifth place in all the polls. This was before the deportation bus stunt that he pulled that got the most national attention and also secured his last place finish. But he pleaded guilty to those charges, was sentenced to 4 years probation, 120 hours of community service and a small fine. And the records were sealed, so we're not sure if that involved any sort of cooperation with authorities about any more charges.
Okay. Just wanted to put a punctuation mark, a finish to the Michael Williams story. I know Cody feels terrible for poor Michael Williams.
it's actually a very sad story because I think if you talk to some of the folks that served with Michael Williams in the state Senate would say that he was a nice guy. I got to know him briefly during the campaign even. He seemed to be a very nice guy. He has a beautiful family, a little girl that was just born actually during the campaign. It's incredibly sad that something like this happened, but I'm glad that the legal process worked its way through.
He was not the publicity hound. He was not like a grenade thrower that he came to be during the...
Yeah, I get that. And Cody, I thought that was actually a really lovely statement, but I don't think we should forget, Stacey Evans, that this is the guy who stood there with an immigration bus...
That broke down.
That broke down on the highway.
I mean, all right, that's
it's
enough.
A pretty, pretty hateful campaign.
You do see how people change during these campaigns, especially if they get bad advice.
All right, let's move on. Greg, there's a new candidate in the 6th District, a Republican candidate for that congressional seat, now owned by Lucy McBath. She's Nicole Rodden. And I wanted to talk about her briefly because she's kind of an interesting person. She was a merchant marine. She was in the Naval Reserve. She's a pretty conservative Republican. Let's just listen to a clip from her video announcing her candidacy.
People don't look at me and think merchant mariner, Naval Reserve officer, or just being involved in any kind of work environment where I sometimes was the only female. When there's this false perception of what a person is supposed to look like in a certain field, I'm so glad that I've broken the mold.
One of the things that's interesting about her is that her mother is Ecuadorian or Ecuadorian, and her father is Greek. So she's kind of got an unusual ethnic background. What does this mean for Karen handle to suddenly have another woman in that race up there?
I mean, it could be trouble for her, but also she's the best known candidate among the three Republicans we know of now. And there's going to be another Republican entering the race soon. But she's the best known candidate in the field, of course, because she's run for statewide office several times, Senate, Governor, Secretary of State. She's won that district in the most expensive U.S. House race in the nation's history back in that special election just 2 years ago. So the fact that there's even more candidates could also help her, because if she gets 35-40% of the vote, no matter what, she'll get into a runoff. Of course, what she wants is to get the 50+1 and avoid any sort of overtime in that race and make it a clean victory so that she can take on Lucy McBath in the general election. This new candidate, Rodden's taking on a lot of the messages, echoing the themes that Karen Handel re-entered the race with as well, though, talking about liberal socialism and basically the anti-AOC message that a lot of Republicans are taking on, she is as well.
Yeah, we should remember that candidates up there, those are their videos. There's pictures of AOC, pictures of Ilhan Omar, pictures of Nancy Pelosi, Stacey, and all of it now, the central theme that's emerging for Republican candidates in congressional races and from President Trump is the Democrats want to impose socialism on Americans.
Yeah, it's an interesting spin on the truth, but I applaud the effort, and I appreciate the Republicans making a centrist out of Nancy Pelosi, which is essentially what's happened. But I think Nicole Rodden seems like exactly the kind of candidate that would make a great Republican candidate for the 6th Congressional District and really give Lucy McBath a good run, which is probably exactly why she will never get out of the Republican primary.
Well, I will say there is a comparison to AOC. I watched the video, and there was a little bit of AOC, Beto O'Rourke, in there. I mean, I think she was doing her hair and, you know, filming her husband. I do think, Greg makes a very good point. This is going to be an expensive race. And it takes money to get your name ID up. I don't know if she's going to self-fund, if she's going to go out and raise money. I don't think she's very well known in the grassroots and business community. I guess the next disclosure period ends on June 30th, so we'll see how much money she can put in the bank. Karen Handel has very high name ID, and so she's not going to need as much money as some of these unknown candidates will. I think one dynamic, too, is, you know, you have a lot of consultants out there right now that are shopping for candidates, and they're finding these candidates and selling them on how I'm going to make you the most attractive candidate you can win this primary. They're obviously, you know, have their own vested interest, and I think you're starting to see a lot of that.
That is such a great point, and we haven't talked about that. I'm glad you're, Cody, I know you're agnostic when it comes to Republican primaries.
You aggressively
have to be.
So.
But Eric makes a terrific point. This is the time that consultants, and in fact, we're almost past time in some cases, Republican and Democratic consultants are out there shopping around looking for a paycheck for the 2020 cycle.
It's a feeding frenzy. I think in both the 6th and the 7th, you have to watch a few things. Number one, who's going to raise the money? Because that's crucially important, that I think often goes unnoticed in these kind of conversations. The other one, manpower. You've got to have people that believe in you that'll go knock on doors, put mail pieces in mailboxes for you. And the other thing is you've got to be able to drive a message that is focused. These primaries are going to get dirty, but your overwhelming message has to be something that the average Republican primary voter is going to say, yeah, I like that person. And that's hard to do. It's a whole lot harder than it sounds.
And you have to have a path to victory. Right. I mean, you have to have some sort of semblance of why you can, let's say, if you're Rodden, why you can beat Karen Handel, and who's much better known in the 6th district, or if you're in the 7th district, where there's already, I don't know, a dozen candidates, if you count them all, why there's any sort of path. If you're a Democrat, why you can beat Caroline Bordeaux, and if you're a Republican, how you can emerge from the very, very crowded field.
So we think there might be another woman jumping into the 6th district.
Man.
Another candidate
jumping in
next week
on the GOP side,
on the Republican side, and we expect more candidates in the 7th district. I'm sure that we could be hearing from Renee Unnerman in the near future too on that side. So these races are not yet settled, and they shouldn't be, because it's still a year and a half until the election, but they're starting to gel a little bit more.
All right, this is the sort of item. Did you want to jump in?
I was just going to say, Greg, it feels like, you know, Greg and I often talk to each other more than we do our own families. It feels like we just got done with an election. We're getting started again.
And there are certainly days where I see both the marquee candidates in the gubernatorial race within hours of each other. So,
I want to try to carve out 2 minutes at the end of the show to talk about a relationship that you finally made public between two congressional candidates. But let's put it on hold for just a minute. Maureen Downey, Cody, had a column, her Get Schooled column in the AJC, in which she talked about Common Core, and again, your boss at the Republican convention saying, I think we're going to have to finally get rid of Common Core. And Maureen points out that there's been a misconception about Common Core for a long time now. It was Eric Tannenbaum's former boss, Governor Sonny Perdue, who was co-chair with a number of governors around the United States, who created Common Core. And yet it is now viewed by the most conservative voters out there as having been imposed by the federal government. Do you guys really have a plan to get rid of Common Core that's come together? Or is that sort of an aspirational thing the governor mentioned at the convention?
And so I think that there's been stories on this that Greg's written, where both at the DOE level, at the Department of Education, and our office are working on solutions that we can work on together. I think a couple things. Number one, again, this is something that the governor campaigned on for 2 years that was in almost every stump speech. And it was one of those things where it was in the speech at the convention, and Greg picked it up. But I think, and Eric can forgive me for this answer, I think Common Core, I think a lot of folks can agree that it was a well-intentioned program. But I think in the implementation, it's not just base voters on the Republican side that have negative opinions about the issue. I mean, you had Lori Geary on the other day who was saying that, you know, I am having problems being able to work math and reading with my kids when they come home with schoolwork. And that's something that the governor heard on the campaign trail. People came up and said, look, I think we should have standards, but these things make it so incredibly hard for me to work with my child in classwork. And I think Republicans and Democrats can agree that a child gets the best education when it's not just in the classroom, but whenever their parents can engage at home to help them with their
work. Stacey, this doesn't seem to be an entirely partisan issue. There are parents on both sides of the aisle that seem to have differing views about what Common Core is all about.
Well, I think we have to step back and say, what's the point of education? Is it to make life easier for parents, or is it to educate our kids? It's to educate our kids. I don't want to lower expectations for our kids. I also don't want to be wedded to a style of learning just because it's what I learned, and it makes it easier for me when my kid comes home. I think what Common Core represents is standards. When should a kid be able to do certain things, multiplication, fractions, things like that? So Common Core is not new math, which I think is what we're talking about here without saying it, this new math and the new way that kids are taught to round and add. It's better. We figured out a better way. It's more logical. It's more applicable to more situations. Yes, it's weird if you didn't learn it. I'm going through it with my child right now, but that's my burden.
Yeah.
I'm not going to put a burden on the teachers to tell them not to do something that I know is better for our kids. But that's not Common Core. That's new math.
Well, unfortunately, what Common Core started out to be and what it is today are two different things. And, you know, when it started out, where algebra in Georgia is the same as algebra in New Mexico. Algebra is not different in each state. Unfortunately, what happened was President Obama embraced it. And we live in this hyper-partisan society.
He created
today.
Race to the top and embraced the Common Core standards
and spun out of control. And now you can't even have a conversation about what was really the original intent.
Yeah. All right. We're running out of time. We'll see how that unfolds. Cody, we're waiting to see what your boss is going to do about this. And we'll talk about it, I guarantee you. Greg, finally, we've only got a minute or so. You blew the whistle the other day on a long-held secret on this
secret.
Show. Two of our panelists on Political Rewind, who've been on frequently, we've known for a long time. They were kind of crazy about each other, and now they're each running for Congress, and you wrote about them the other day.
Yeah, it was really interesting. Brenda Lopez, Michael Owens. It's not like it was any secret to anyone in Democratic circles or any who had been
one of the worst kept secrets.
Exactly. Yeah. Very, very, very badly kept secret or on Facebook. But once they both announced they were running for different congressional seats,
he's in the 13th and she's up there in the 7th.
In the 7th, we thought it'd be a really interesting story about two candidates, two star-crossed lovers from across Metro Atlanta running for different seats. And very rarely, we've had congressional couples before, but very rarely are they both challenged running for open seats. We found no examples of any candidates running in separate districts as a couple.
All right.
At the same time.
Well, without regard to whether their political philosophies are right or wrong, whether they're Democrats, which they both happen to be or not, oh my gosh. I don't know about you, Stacey, but I hope they both either win or both either lose, because any other outcome is going to make life miserable for one of them.
Completely agree. Completely agree.
That's it for today's show. We're out of time. Stacey Evans, Eric Tannenblatt, Cody Hall, Greg Bluestein, thank you so much for being here. We're off tomorrow. But we're back at 2 o'clock on Friday. I hope you can join us for Political Rewind. And again, go to politicalrewind.org and sign up to come see us in Cartersville next Monday night at 7 o'clock. Take care.